welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are going straight into content, or at least as fast as we can, as soon as we get through some of the obligatory starting lineup or the things we say at the very beginning, such as this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and that this is the only show that provides you with the academic evidence of where we've been, where we're going, and what we need to do. So we give you the academic-based solutions. And when I say academic, I'm not talking about the progressive academic. I'm talking about exactly how the Constitution was defined by the framers and how they stipulated what needed to be done. And we prove this. I mean, this is why we actually read the source documents instead of giving you just editorializing. And when we get into content, what that means is we're actually giving you source documents today. We're also, you know, going to editorialize a little bit because we have that latitude, but we want you to prove us wrong. And we're actually going to, today, we're going to do something unusual. We're going to give you the revisionist view of how they were and they interpret the Missouri Compromise, because, as you know, we're focused on the Missouri Compromise today. And so with that, I want to thank you for tuning in. We like seeing our numbers going up. We would like to actually see this show become the dominant show in America and in the world, because I believe that liberty is, I don't think the good Lord wants liberty to be limited to just those of us who live within the geographic boundaries of the United States, whether that be the contiguous or the extended states and territories. I believe that all people should be able to enjoy liberty. Some of them aren't ready. There's many countries out there that are just not ready to become a state, but that doesn't mean they can't be put on the path to statehood. It's kind of like there's lots of, did Christ look for the perfect people to become his apostles? Were they ready to be an apostle? According to him, they were. He put them on the path of apostleship. Right? I mean, he took, I forget who was the tax collector. Was that Peter? Paul? Anyway, you know, I tell you, I'm bad with names and those types of things. But bottom line is, there's no doubt in my mind that when we start putting states on the pathway to statehood, they then start learning and they start conforming. Either they do or they don't. And if they don't, then we'll let them go. But there's no money in it for somebody to become a state of the United States. This concept of entitlements and be able to come and you can get the, you know, free money and that type of stuff, that is not why people should be enticed to becoming to the United States, because it's unconstitutional. That's not there. They shouldn't be doing that and can't do that. I mean, there are some things that we help in creating the infrastructure, but that's it. What's in it for everybody? Liberty. Excuse me, that's what's in it for everybody. And as you know, with the Biden administration, it seems like the globalist progressive war has, you know, taken it's rooted itself and it's taken its place in the heart of America. And we have to recognize that we have to take this fight to where they will lose and where we will win. You always take the fight to where you have the advantage. And going into court and dealing with the federal government in Washington, D.C. is where they have the advantage. This is why the Constitution was done in such a way that the advantage was always at the state level. Getting people to understand this and waking up is the bane of my existence. Well, anyway. And so, as you know, we're living in a constitutional crisis because we have an unconstitutional president. I can't emphasize enough that because Congress accepted an unconstitutional electoral college, we now have a president who should never have been selected. And as a matter of fact, even though the popular vote or whatever you want to call the steal, the stuffing the ballot box, whatever you want to call it, bottom line is we don't have a president that is qualified yet. Fortunately, we don't have the Speaker of the House because she would become a queen and or a monarch because that's her paradigm. That's how she thinks. Fact of the matter is we do not have a constitutionally qualified and selected president. What should have happened was they should have rejected the Electoral College, period. Pence was wrong. He should be held accountable to this. All of these people should be held accountable to this. And so what we need to do is just kind of plug away so that people start understanding. But what we can do is we can get the states to actually start standing up. And we're going to get into some strategies that we're putting out there that we want you to get behind. But let's get through this content, because I promised you we were going to do the Missouri Compromise and the Monroe Doctrine. But in between, there's this little little letter from James Madison to John G. Jackson that we want to inject, because I want to get this in the right timeline. And so the letter to John G. Jackson was 1821. The Missouri Compromise was around, 1819, 1820, something like that. Anyway, so let's kind of set the stage here for the Missouri Compromise. As you know, the Constitutional Convention dealt with slavery. And I mean, they spoke about the elephant in the room. The desire to get rid of slavery was the majority in the room. What ended up happening was Georgia and the two Carolinas threatened to leave the Union and not be a part of this process unless they were able to keep their slave businesses. And so at the point of creating the compromise, one of the things that they put in was the 1808 shutting down of the slave trade. And Madison was absolutely adamant the fact that the slave trade needed to be shut down immediately as soon as the federal government came to be. But they created a compromise. It was a 20-year delay. This is why in 1808, the slave trade was then to be shut down by the federal government, by the small little clause that doesn't even stand out and doing that. And this is where Madison, you know, kind of yelled in everybody's face, even though that's not his temperament. That's not really what he did. But I mean, he poked everybody in the eye by saying, who is going to remember in 1808, there's this small little clause that tells the general government that they need to shut down the slave trade? Huh? Who here is going to remind them of that? And basically, because who's going to remember in 20 years, right? The other thing that they put in was the 3/5 rule. And the South wanted to have full representation because they wanted to treat slaves as property, but they wanted to have the full recognition that they were people that deserved representation. And so Congress, or I should say the Northerners, basically said that, well, okay, so if you're going to treat them as property, they can't be they can't be apportioned. So it was a political compromise. But what they did and what we're going to show you with the Missouri Compromise is that because of the shutting down of the slave trade in 1808, advantages started coming into the House of Representatives. And actually, as planned, it was going to come into the states or in the Senate as well. So that over time, they knew that that Congress would move towards anti-slavery. It was just set up to be because of the 3/5 rule, the shutting down of the slave trade, and so forth. And so, great. Now, in 1808, do you think that the slave trade would have been shut down had Madison not been president? Huh? I'm telling you, it was the divine hand of providence that made sure that it was Madison that happened to be president so that he would remember. And those words he said in the Constitutional Convention resonated loudly in his mind. And one of the first things he did was he started shutting down the slave trade. He started exerting resources and what have you to shut down, to make sure that slaves were not being imported into America. Now, the South tried to sidestep this by, you know, having the slaves go into Central America and then have a manifest from Central America bringing them in. And so they discovered these shenanigans that the South was pulling. But, you know, it wasn't 100% effective, but it was effective enough to start influencing the outcome of, you know, this policy that they started recognizing. It didn't take too long, and the Missouri Compromise was the evidence that this, it was starting to happen. Now, you also have to remember that through the presidencies, we had been fighting Britain since the Revolutionary War. They had been, you know, harassing, they had been doing everything they could to show us that they're the big bully on the block and they were not going to let us just get away. And so the War of 1812 then occurred and we kicked their butts. And actually we kicked their butts, even though they did a lot of damage, they burnt down DC and so forth, they got their butts kicked to a point that we even signed the treaty. I believe the Treaty of Ghent was done, or at least we were moving towards the treaty when Andrew Jackson, you know, went into the South and kicked their butts even further. And so just so you understand that up until the 1814 Treaty of Ghent, America had these overlooming hostilities from foreign adversaries, France, believe it or not, France, Spain, but mainly England, because, like I said, they were the big bully on the block. We'll be right back after these two promos. Please stay tuned. We're going to be diving more and deeper into this content. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we got this Treaty of Ghent, and it took effect in 1815. Okay, so now we're kind of really moving, and at this point in time, we really seize control of our shipping lanes because England and the UK, or Britain at the point in time, started actually honoring the agreements within the treaty that we would be able to let our commerce flow freely. The impressments were stopping and so forth, which means that the shutting down of the slave trade was becoming even more effective.
as we started moving forward, one of the things that started coming out was, okay, well, we've got this new state coming along, and it was Missouri. And this was actually happening after, I believe it happened after Madison's leaving office, because I think they petitioned to become state in 1818. We'll get into it. But what, and the reason why this is important is because it was just another political compromise that furthered, and this was being driven by those who had the big money. Now, you just understand that institutions like corporations and banks and so forth, the larger the institution, the more political clout they carry. And so I'm telling you this because those institutions in America in those days were the plantations and plantation owners, because they were the ones that had the most political clout. And so it was truly a political compromise, this thing we call the Missouri Compromise. Before we get into the Missouri Compromise and before we get into Missouri being added as a state, well, let's actually read what the Constitution says about a new state being admitted. It says Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 1. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state. In other words, you can't have a state in a state. Nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states without the consent of the legislatures of those states concerned, as well as of the Congress. Okay, so okay. So they talk about, you know, the limitations that a state can't be, you know, come up in a state, and the states that are bordering other states, they have to have the approval of those other states. Subsection 2, Article 4, Section 3. The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Now, I want to point this out. This does not say that they have the power to regulate needful rules and regulations in states, only the territories. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So just to be clear, there's nowhere in the Constitution that gave Congress the power to create stipulations other than putting states on the path of equal footing and making sure that they have constitutions and those types of things. And that's why we really want to go through the Missouri Compromise and the, you know, the legislation that actually allowed Missouri into the Union. Now, the Missouri Compromise was never really written down. At least I've never found it. And it's not that it doesn't exist, because everybody acknowledges that this was a compromise, like a gentleman's agreement, that any state that was across a parallel line of latitude that goes across the United States, any state that is south of that is to be a slave state, and any state north of that was to be a free state. Well, California kind of perturbed that, but anyway, that was many years later. But the bottom line is the Missouri Compromise, I'm making it for the record, the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. The federal government had no power to dictate to a state. And we'll get into the facts as we go through this. And you'll see that what they were doing was contrary to the self-destiny and self-sovereignty that a state rightfully has. The other important thing about states becoming a part of the union is that they don't just join the union, they become principal parties to the Constitution. And this is why I want to read Article 7, because this is where it clearly states who the parties of the compact are. The ratification of the conventions of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states so ratifying the same. So in other words, every state that comes into the union becomes an equal participant and an equal party of the compact, so that they have equal say whether the federal government is complying or not complying. The biggest thing that the federal government has done that they've been very successful in doing, by the way, is keeping the states divided. you know, giving them a little money here for this and giving another state the money for that, and it may be contrary. It's doing things to keep them divided. And so divide and conquer, they did, and we have been. But that can change when we put aside our differences and our self-interest and stand and unite on the Constitution. That's what states need to do. That's what everybody needs to do. Anyway, so let's dive into the compromise that sullied the soul of America. And what I want to do is I want to highlight, because I'm reading this account, because it's decent, but they're very misleading, and I'm going to tell you how. But the history.com kind of gives you the, you know, a narrative of the timeline. So this is from history.com. When the Missouri Territory was applied for statehood in 1808, it was clear that many in the territory wanted to allow slavery in the new state. Okay, so they're making this assertion. It was clear that many in the territory wanted to allow slavery in the new state. I'm telling you, this in no way was a majority of the people. When they use the word many, the many that they're talking about are many with money who could afford a plantation and afford taking care of a large body or large group of slaves. Most people, as a matter of fact, Thomas Sowell pointed this out, that most people in the South, most people couldn't afford to do that. And they couldn't afford to compete with these large plantations either. Remember that the Civil War, and I've said this before time and time again, and I got to repeat it. The Civil War and secession was started because of less than 1,000 men in the South. It was like 800 and something. But less than 1,000 men in the South who were large plantation owners or slave owners who wanted to preserve their institution called slavery. And if you look at the millions of people in the South at the time, you know, that was really disingenuous and unfair that this small minority was able to inflict the pain and the anguish upon the Southerners, their fellow brethren and so forth. Anyway, if you start looking at the history of slavery and so forth, you really can start putting it in perspective that it was the elitist that had the money, that had the influence with those, you know, because when it came down to people that were running for office, they would get the money to run their campaigns and so forth from these plantation owners. So they became the monkeys on the string, and the plantation owners were the organ grinders, if you understand what I'm saying. Anyway, going back to what history.com says, part of the more than 800,000 square miles bought from France in the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, it was also known as the Louisiana Territory in 1812 when it was renamed to avoid confusion with the newly admitted state, Louisiana. The Missouri's bid to become the first state west of the Mississippi and to allow slavery within its borders set off a bitter debate in Congress that was, like the nation itself, already divided into pro- and anti-slavery factions. And absolutely. But I'm telling you that it wasn't really as divided evenly. It was divided evenly as far as the elite is concerned, but not as far as the people. The majority of the people, and we will prove this, the majority of the people in Missouri did not want and like to see slavery. And the Dred Scott case proves that when we get there. In the North, where abolitionist sentiments was growing, and it was growing at neckbreak speed, I might add, many people opposed, because most all the states by this point in time in the North had all abolished slavery and mandated that all these states, all these slaves be freed. And so many people opposed the extension of the institution of slavery into the new territory. And as a matter of fact, the Northwest Ordinance also forbid the expanse into the West of allowing slavery. That was done by Thomas Jefferson. Anyway, many worried that adding Missouri as a slave state would upset the balance that currently existed between slave and free states in the Union. Pro-slavery Southerners, meanwhile, argued that new states, like the original 13, should be given the freedom to choose whether to permit slavery or not. As a matter of fact, it's not that they should be given. It is their constitutional right to determine their destiny. What a state wants to do is up to the state. The federal government, there was nowhere in that language that dictated the states could determine what a state must be. They had no constitutional standing. It was unconstitutional, and that was actually supported later. Anyway, during the debate, Representative James Talmadge of New York proposed an amendment to the statehood bill that would have eventually ended slavery in Missouri and set the existing enslaved workers there free. The amendment bill passed narrowly as we go into this break. And so I'll continue on with this adage or this editorializing, but we will be getting actually into the bill that created Missouri statehood, and you'll see why this is important because it proves many of the things that I have been postulating. So we'll be right back after this. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so as I was so rudely interrupted by myself, let me get back to this this compromise here. And as a matter of fact, again, this is history.com kind of giving you the narrative and or kind of giving you a count-by-count their editorializing of what happened. Anyway, they were talking about Talmadge and this amendment, and the amendment bill passed narrowly in the House of Representatives, where Northerners held a slight edge. I disagree. As a matter of fact, you got to remember that the 18-8 clause was starting to get enforced. We still had these problems from the British government until 1815. So the advantages were starting to really be realized that the anti-slavery abolition movement was growing. And so what I believe all the power brokers, and as a matter of fact, I talk about this in my book as well, they knew in the early 1800s how important it was to ensure, because I believe John Adams, via Alexander Hamilton, who was not necessarily an abolitionist, he was all about power and control. he gave Adams a very good list of those slavery supporters for jurists that stacked the courts for the slavery side, because there were a lot of shenanigans between the New York, if you want to call them the New York politicians, and the slave influence in the South. They created this coalition because look at Martin Van Buren. There you go. He was a New Yorker, and he was the one that aligned himself with the power brokers of slavery in the South in ensuring that in instituting the gag rule on slavery in the Senate so that they couldn't even talk about slavery. So understanding who is playing and how these alliances were being created, there were people that was sullying, if not selling, the soul of America and going down these paths, all in the name of power and control. So anyway, the amended bill passed narrowly, so we already got through and was basically, you know, got through the, you know, the House, where free slave states exactly the same number of senators. Okay, so the Northerners held a slight edge. That's where I left off. But in the Senate, where free and slave states had exactly the same number of senators, the pro-slavery faction managed to strike out Talmadge's amendment, and the House refused to pass the bill without it. So there was that much control between the abolitionists and the slave states. Now, one of the things that you start looking at was how was it that the Senate was being controlled when, again, most of the people in these slave states weren't pro-slavery. There weren't people that said, hey, slavery's a good thing. As a matter of fact, the majority of the people looked at it as a bad thing because it created an uneven advantage between those who had money and protected it and those who didn't. And this is where George Fitzhugh started postulating just about two decades later that all people, white and black, should be slaves. He was a socialist and was a proponent for communism. Anyway, back to this whole diatribe from history.com. After the stalemate, Missouri renewed its application for statehood in the late 1819. This time, Speaker of the House Henry Clay proposed that Congress admit Missouri into the Union as a slave state, but at the same time admit Maine, which at the same time was a part of Massachusetts, as a free state. Now, I want you to understand how this was a huge advantage for the slavery side, because how many people were in Maine? How much of Maine was really being stripped and cleaned and cleared for agricultural purposes or manufacturing? Maine was literally just carved out to create a state out of Massachusetts so that they would then have a less represented state against a highly represented state of Missouri. How many representatives did Maine get in contrast to Missouri? Because we're going to go through how many, and I could actually count it out, but one of the reasons why we go through this is because how they actually set up congressional districts back in the day, because it's really, really important. So anyway, let me just kind of move forward. In February 1820, the Senate added a second part to the joint statehood bill. With the exception of Missouri, slavery would be banned in all of the former Louisiana Purchase north of this imaginary latitude. This is where I tell you, this is where they came up with this line, that any states south of this line would actually be a slave state. Any states north of this line, it was the 36 degrees, 30 minutes latitude, which ran across from the East Coast to the West Coast. On March 3rd, 1820, the House passed the Senate version of the bill, and President James Monroe signed into law 4 days later that bill. The following month, the former President Thomas Jefferson wrote to a friend that the Missouri question, like a fireball in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. He knew this was repugnant to the spirit and the design of this constitutional republic. He knew that states must be free to foreordain their destiny, not to be dictated by the federal government. Jefferson goes on and says, I considered it at once as the knell of the Union. And what does he mean by K-N-E-L-L? The toll, the peal, the ringing bell, that resonating sound that was going to be the end of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment, but is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. And so the day must come when I believe, and he believed, that, and even Mason said, that we are going to head into a very bloody war. That America, as Mason stated in the Constitutional Convention, that because God can't punish states and nations in heaven, he will punish this nation and these states for keeping this abomination called slavery in America. Anyway, moving on, History.com then goes on and says, though the Missouri Compromise managed to keep the peace for the moment, it failed to resolve the pressing questions of slavery and its place in the nation's future. Southerners who opposed the Missouri Compromise did so because it set a precedent for Congress to make laws concerning slavery, while Northerners disliked the law because it meant slavery was expanded into the new territory. In the decades after 1820, as westward expansion continued and more of the Louisiana Purchase lands were organized as territories, the question of the slavery's extension continued to divide the nation. Now, there's no doubt that there's absolute truth to this, but we want to make sure that people understand that there wasn't a high majority of those who wanted slaves. Those who actually went into the West didn't want slaves because they didn't have the money. They couldn't afford to do that type of stuff. In taking care of that many more people. I mean, people just had a hard time taking care of all the kids that they were having. And in essence, if you understand why people had so many kids in those days, was for the work on the farm, on the family business, or what have you. That was the family business, having kids and getting work done. Anyway, the Compromise of 1850, which admitted California to the Union as a free state, required California to send one pro-slavery senator to maintain the balance of power in the Senate. And so one of the things that has to be pointed out is that in 1850, when California was being admitted, it was already south of this imaginary line, and lo and behold, it was being admitted as a slave state, so they already moved away from the Missouri Compromise. In 1854, during the organization of Kansas and Nebraska Territory, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois spearheaded the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which mandated that settlers of each territory should decide the issue of slavery for themselves, a principle known as popular sovereignty. The controversial law effectively repealed the Missouri Compromise by allowing slavery in the region of the north of 36 and 30 degrees parallel, and the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act sparked violence between pro- and anti-slavery settlers in bleeding Kansas, delaying Kansas's admission to the Union. And I'm telling you that those people who were pro-slavery were those who had the influence. And when you have influence, let me ask you something. If you have the mantle of power, if you're holding the bully stick, do you want to give that up? No, absolutely not. So these people wanted to maintain, and they were the minority. But you got to understand that he who pays the piper calls the tune. And these people were spoiled and enabled by a political system that gave them influence. And this is the corruption of America. And this is the same direction we're going by the corruption of America with the progressives. It's all about slavery, my friends. It's always been about slavery. It's only the new innovation of slavery today that enslaves us to the state where we actually have a fair and just slave master, the government. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so plowing forward, the opposition to the act, and we're talking about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the opposition to the act led to the formation of the Republican Party and the emergence of a national problem, a prominence of Douglas's Illinois rival, a former obscure lawyer who failed in almost everything he did, Abraham Lincoln. Bitter controversy also surrounded the United States. And so you have to understand that when the Democratic Party kind of took its prominence with Andrew Jackson, the Federalist, or I should say the Republican Party that Madison created, Madison and Jefferson, started moving into obscurity because people just, at this point in time, now that they, you know, were free and they were creating this abundance or this, let's say, an excess from taxes, they were actually having extra money. And so Andrew Jackson was really in favor of creating a Department of Transportation if they amended it, because then they could use that money. But he wasn't in favor of violating the Constitution. However, he was violating the Constitution because he would indiscriminately use money for things that were unconstitutional. Well, that use of that money became more and more prevalent in supporting farmers, and that's what created the Department of Agriculture. And it's the same thing with supporting the railroad system that was opening up the West. The federal government was very heavy in subsidizing, giving land and all sorts of unconstitutional things in helping out a business. Maybe it was for noble purposes, but as George Washington said, this is the tool of how republics and how governments are destroyed. Anyway, bitter controversy also surrounded the U.S. Supreme Court's 1957 decision in the Dred Scott v. Sanford, which ruled the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. But what's really important is what actually happened in the Dred Scott case. So the Dred Scott case Dred Scott was a case that was a black man who was suing for his freedom. And he was tried in Missouri by 12 white men. That was his jury. And these 12 white men let him and actually released him to his freedom because they felt that Dred Scott had done his time. His master died. They looked at the eyes, they looked at the law, and they felt that this man should be free. Well, that wasn't good enough, and so the Missouri elitist wanted to make sure that they basically contested and appealed this decision by these 12 white men to go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court actually made an unconstitutional ruling that they don't show in history.com because they don't want to necessarily show the federal government as the bad players here. But Taney himself basically said black men can't be citizens when there was actually evidence of states already in the Union that were making black men or freemen citizens. They were actually allowed to vote in those states. And I'm trying to remember, I think Thomas Sowell points this out as well as Mark Levin in their books. So this isn't news, but the fact of the matter is, you know, the Supreme Court gets lauded here by History.com, but they don't poke him in the eye for really why were they even ruling? They should have just basically said, hey, he was already set free by these jurors. We don't have, you know, a case here just because you don't like the outcome. Anyway, according to Chief Justice Roger B. Taney and six other justices, Congress had no power to prohibit slavery in the territories, as the Fifth Amendment guaranteed slave owners could not be deprived of their property without due process of law. The 14th Amendment, passed in 1865 after the conclusion of the Civil War, would later overturn major parts of the Dred Scott decision that they were actually to be freed and to be given rights and so forth. You know, it's really important to understand the essence of liberty and what this nation and what this Constitution really did. And there were people that tried to straddle the fence, and Taney was one of those, and many people in the court systems was one. But 9 times out of 10, ever since John Marshall in the 1800s and the Midnight Judges, that is when jurists started using activism by the bench and started using their position to force changes that they felt were best but were unconstitutional. So anyway, what I'm going to do now is we're going to actually go through selected highlights. We're actually going to go through the bulk of it, but I'll probably, you know, kind of skim over some of this stuff. But we only have like 5 minutes left in this show, so we're going to really span this because there's a lot of stuff that we need to cover in the Missouri Compromise, not necessarily because it covers the Missouri Compromise, but this covers information that I've given you before, and I want to confirm how, at this point in time in the 1820s, how states and how congressional districts were set up and so forth, and equal footing and some of these concepts that states were sovereign. States had, they were the parties of the compact. And the federal government, when they were allowing new states into the Union, they were basically allowing, the federal government was allowing another parent to come to the trough. And over time, the federal government figured out, well, we can create the money and make them the slaves of us by giving them money and controlling them. And that's exactly what they did. All of this in contradiction and in absolute violation of the Constitution. So anyway, Section 1, and I want to make sure I'm starting at the, yeah, okay, so Section 1 of the Missouri, and this is the Missouri Enabling Act, or the basically the legislation that allowed Missouri to become a state. Some people call it the Missouri Compromise, but the Missouri Compromise, again, was done outside of this. And so Section 1, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, that the inhabitants of the portion of the Missouri Territory included within the boundaries herein after designated B. And so they're going to actually designate the boundaries, and I'm not going to go through all of that. But as the Fifth Amendment, the inhabitants of the portion of the Missouri Territory included therein after designated B and are hereby authorized to form for themselves a constitution and state government and to assume such name as they shall deem proper. And the said state, when formed, shall be admitted to the Union upon an equal footing. So here it is right here. That shall be admitted to the into the Union upon equal footing with the original states in all aspects whatsoever. Okay, so why is this so important? Because we're going to read later on in here that they're actually going to create stipulations that were never placed or put upon the other states. Huh. Interesting. So in other words, in all respects whatsoever, except pay no attention to our other hand because we're going to be slapping you. Okay, so section 2, defined boundaries. And I just want to tell you that they've literally started in one corner and they went up the river to the center of the river to this coordinate and then came in. And this is how that state was created, by creating the absolute boundaries. And if you know how Missouri is, there's lots of little turns and corners. It's not like a square state. And so when they had to distinguish what those boundaries were, they had to be very specific as to where this boundary ended. And this is the same thing with the survey of your property. You own physical property, and so you would think that you'd own the soil rights. And we're going to get into the actual mineral rights that the federal government started denying states mineral rights by this time. And we'll get into that. Anyway, Section 2 defined the boundaries and that the said state shall have concurrent jurisdiction on the River Mississippi and every other river bordering on the said state so far as the said river shall form a common boundary to the said state and any other state or states now or hereafter to be formed and bound by the same, such rivers to be common to both. In other words, when there's a river going along, they have concurrent, not a subordinate and superior relationship, but concurrent, an equal relationship and equal jurisdiction over that river so that one state can't have an advantage over the other. And so this is important because that would have been in line with equal footing. And that the River Mississippi and so forth into the same shall be common highways and forever free as well to the inhabitants of the said state as to other citizens of the United States without any tax, duty, impost, toll, therefore imposed by the said state. So in other words, in line with the Constitution, that states cannot create taxes for commerce to flow through their land other than those things that would be reasonable that the state would, you know, like in a port or if, like the railroad. If you've got a railroad going through there and the state was responsible, but see, the states weren't responsible for railroads. The federal government got their knickers involved in this, and they were the ones that started creating these protections for the railroad company. And so we can blame the federal government for ruining the railroads because they didn't allow them to fairly compete. Anyway, we're done for today. I'm G.R. Mobley. We'll be back with this. I'm Reclaiming the Republic. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.